thank you very much for the invitation to come here. This is my first time in Sheffield, and I'm looking forward to get to know all of you much better. We have a nice back and forth and discussion. I think it's a wonderful book to get introduced to Marxist humanism. It's actually the first of Dunayevskaya's four books that she published in her lifetime, and there's an additional book, a collection of her writings on Hegel and the dialectic that Kevin Anderson and myself edited and published a few years after her death in 1987. It came out in like 2004 or so. But Marxism and Freedom is really kind of a classic of the left, and some of you are aware of the book, some of you have read it, I'm sure. So I'll just give just some basic ideas of what I think makes it worthwhile to study for today. So a little bit of context first. The book was first published in 1958. She had been Trotsky's secretary in the late 30s as a very young woman, but she broke from Trotsky over the Hitler-Stalin Pact, which she felt could not be endorsed, even critically. In 1940-41, she did independent research and concluded by 41 or 42, in some published articles, that the Soviet Union was actually neither a worker state nor socialist nor transitional to either one, but that was a state capitalist society. She joined forces with C.L.I. James. There were a dissident faction within the Trotskyist movement for a number of years. And out of the discussions, debates, and theoretical developments, eventually came, by 1958, this book, Marxism and Freedom, from 1776 until today. And the title is something I'm going to spend a few minutes on, actually, because the title is meaningful and maybe more significant than it will appear at first sight. The basic reason the book was written, I would think, is to try to rescue Marxism from the oblivion of Stalinism. We're all aware of this, but of course it's easy to forget how powerful the pull of Stalinism was. One third of the landmass of the world by the late 1940s, 1950s, was controlled by so-called socialist or communist regimes, that really Stalinist regimes. And the real question mark that this raised, given the horrendous oppression that was accompanying them, is will the very idea of Marxism as a liberatory perspective fall from view, given the fact that these regimes continue to claim the mantle, in some sense, of Marxism or Marxist-Leninism. And so there was a great, not only a practical crisis, but there was a ideological crisis, a crisis of imagination, a risk that the vision of freedom that was organic to Marx's work would be equated with its opposite, or would be subsumed under various forms of this kind of new phenomenon. And it's in that sense that Marxism and Freedom is therefore a book that undergoes a development. Originally, the book was going to be called State Capitalism and Marxism. So it was primarily going to try to demonstrate a new stage of world production, which he called state capitalism, which manifested itself especially in the Soviet Union and later in communist China, which has some interesting chapters, by the way, on China, which I hope you guys will get to when you study the book, which he wrote later in the second edition of 1964 to the book. But the book transformed from state capitalism and Marxism into Marxism and freedom. And there's a tale to be told there as to why that is, and it might give an entree into your own study of the work. Because what preoccupied her was that, of course, there were many tendencies, as you all know, especially within Trotskyism, that took a firm and strong position against Stalinism. But she became increasingly dissatisfied with them, including those that she was associated with over time, because she felt that the opposition to Stalinism was primarily political, or stopped at the political, and did not go deep enough both to answer the economic roots of Stalinism, but also did not go deep enough to question how a transformation at the opposite of the Russian Revolution like this could occur, and most importantly of all, what did the rise of Stalinism suggest about what was being lost sight of in terms of Marx's vision of liberation, and that had to be recaptured for the world that we're living in. So she decided to recast the book Marxism and Freedom to bring that dimension out. She went, in a certain sense, from state capitalist theory to developing, by the 1950s, a philosophy that she began to call Marxist humanism. This was in the period of the Hungarian Revolution of 1956 that the book is being finally completed. And it's the period where Marx's 1844 manuscripts, also known as the Humanist Essays, where he calls himself a humanist, first begins to get now public recognition and renown, at least in the English-speaking world. And in fact, the first edition of the book contained the first translation of sections of Marx's 1844 Humanist Essays, the Paris manuscripts of 1844. So it was humanism that she wanted to focus on as the alternatives to state capitalism, not bourgeois humanism, not liberal humanism, not enlightenment humanism, but revolutionary humanism that was being occluded or eclipsed by the phenomenon of both social democracy on one side and Stalinism on the other, not to mention what was happening with the law of motion of capitalism. So that's a controversial thing right away, because I don't know how much true it is now, but I know when I came into the movement, a lot of people on the left were very embarrassed about the word freedom. You know, Milton Friedman wrote a very famous book, Capitalism and Freedom. You know, capitalists always say they're for freedom, and that freedom for capitalism, et cetera, they appropriate the concept of freedom for their own purposes and everything else. And Herbert Marcuse, who wrote the preface to the first edition of Marxism and Freedom, they had become acquainted in the but about 1953 and 1954 or so, and carried on very, very intensive correspondence pretty much for the next 30 years, though they had many, many differences between them as well. Marcuse himself advised her against the title. He thought that Marxism and Freedom would sound too soapy. So I want to talk a little bit in a second about why she chose that as a title and what significance that may have for today. Just before doing that, I do want to point out something that Marcuse does in the preface to the book, which is really remarkable. He makes a point that very few people get. And he says the following. He says, Marxian theory does not describe and analyze the capitalist economy in and for itself, but describes and analyzes it in terms of another than itself, in terms of the historical possibilities which have become realistic goals for action. In other words, Marcuse caught something here, that Marx's own theory is not simply an empirical analysis or a critical analysis of capitalism, but it's a critical analysis of capitalism that describes it in terms of something other than itself. He describes capitalism through the prism of a concept of socialism. Most Marxists have basically assumed that, well, Marx was against utopianism, so he never talked about socialism or communism. And he was simply doing like an analysis of a critique of existing conditions. But that begs the question, how do you manage to do a critique of existing conditions and have such a profound critique of those conditions if you don't have a conception of the alternative to those conditions? Why would you question wage labor or value production or surplus value or all these different phenomena unless you felt that there was something fundamentally perverse about them? And you would only feel there's something perverse about them if you sense or soar or conceptualize the other side of the problem, right? The lack of those things. Marcuse was really onto something important there, that you can only fully grasp the present from the perspective, even if it's not fully developed, of some kind of conception of the future. I'm going to come back to that in a second because I think that's really where the book speaks to today in many respects. But getting back to this question of freedom, she wanted that to be a focal point of the book, how Marx's philosophy is a free philosophy. And, you know, I'm not somebody who's... I teach at a working-class community college outside of Chicago, so it's not a fancy academic institution by any means. And I chose to teach at this type of institution because that's who I want to be around, that's who I prefer to teach. And it's always striking to me when you have freshman students who come in who never know anything about Marxism except the stereotypes they learn from whoever. And I have them start just reading the 1844 manuscripts. And it's always gets a gleam in my eye when it takes about 3 or 4 weeks, but very often students will suddenly raise their hand and say, wait a second, this is not what I expected. And I say, what do you mean? He says, well, this guy really was for freedom, Marx. I said, yeah, of course, that's what I said the first day. But this incubus of like associating Marx or Marxism with some forms of totalitarian control, authoritarianism, or restrictions of individual freedom is so deep, right? And then when you read Marx and you can see that, hey, it's a totally different thing. That's a liberating moment. There's another part of the title that I do want to mention, not being chauvinist here. from 1776 until today, right? What was 1776? The beginning of the American Revolution. You know, we used to be a colony, don't forget. And you used to be a colonial power, don't forget, I'm not blaming you. She also wanted to establish the American roots of Marxism. That is, any Marxist has to try to establish what's the roots of Marxism within your own culture, within your own history. This is something Lenin did. His first book was on development of capitalism in Russia. What Luxembourg did, her first book was on industrial development of Poland. A serious Marxist begins with their native land and tries to see where things, where it comes from. Okay, so that's a bit of just the title and where things go. Now, in terms of studying the book for today, of course, it's a different context than 60 years ago. Hey, how are you feeling? A little better, I hope. Thanks for coming. Stalinism is no longer predominant. There isn't a third of the world under regimes that call themselves socialist or communist. But in a certain sense, what we have now is kind of the problem, maybe in reverse, is that with the triumph of unfettered, let's not call it a triumph, the unfettered development of free market capitalism around the world and the transmutation of Stalin's regimes into one or another variant of market capitalism for the most part, dropping the mask that they were anything other than that, the real fundamental problem is there an alternative to capitalism? And if so, how do we articulate it and conceptualize it? And that is the biggest problem I think we're facing in the left, and it's the biggest need that we're facing in the left, to be able to articulate a viable emancipatory alternative to capitalism. Especially because to do that, what we need is a conception of socialism and communism that is markedly different than what existed in the 20th century, and at the same time deals with the contemporary realities not only of class, but of race and gender, and issues of gay liberation and transgendered rights and national issues, etc., ecological issues. It has to be some sort of conception of the alternative to capitalism that can steer struggles past merely attacking the phenomenal superficial surface problems of capitalism, which are there and real, but simply addressing them on a reform level or a superficial level is not going to fundamentally steer the system in a different humanity in a different direction. So in that sense, I think Dunayevskaya's emphasis on freedom and liberation and the Marxian concept of freedom is very relevant for today for us to rediscover with new eyes, because every generation could see things in Marx's work that probably could not have been noticed earlier. We come to the text now with questions or concerns that other generations didn't have, and we can therefore, in many cases, see things that would not have been seen in an earlier generation. And we really need an emancipatory vision of a post-capitalist society. So when Marcuse made this phrase that I quoted, where he says, Marx analyzed capitalism not in relationship to itself, but in relationship to an other that is not itself. That's exactly, I think, what we need to do today. But that's not what enough is being done of, because it's so hard to conceptualize what that other could be, given the failures and the tragedies of the past 100 years. So I hope that maybe in some way, as you go through the book, you'll find ways on your own that Marxism and freedom may address the present problem that we're facing as revolutionaries, as activists. I'm just going to single out a couple of things that, for me, strike me in thinking more about the book, you know, in light of some of these questions. One of the main points in Marxism and freedom, you'll come across the phrase quite often in the book, is movement from practice. That is, where do ideas come from, and what is theory? It's all wrapped up into this question. She has a beautiful phrase in the beginning of the book where she says, there is not a single idea that has ever been in the head of a genius that was not at least implicitly in the activities of common people beforehand. She really believed that ideas are simply not generated by intellectuals going into their study and coming up with brilliant ideas that the muse gives them. Instead, ideas are generated in response to actual social movements and social struggles and social aspirations. And that's what she means by the movements from practice. Movements from practice that themselves are forms of theory. Marx didn't invent the idea of socialism, I think everybody in this room knows. Marx joined the radical movement. There was already an existing socialist movement, and he entered that movement in order to contest certain versions of socialism that he thought were non-viable. Proudhonism, or Saint-Simonism, or Salinism, state socialism, etc. But his own ideas took shape based on these working class struggles. So this analysis on her part really begins in chapter 1. She has a very fascinating discussion of the French Revolution. You're enjoying something.
Good. You have the same path.
They both underline the quote that you just talked about.
Yeah, we also have it underlined.
Okay, great. All right, good. Glad to hear. So one thing you get right in the first chapter is on the French Revolution. Very short chapter, a fascinating chapter on the French Revolution and Hegel. Where does Hegel's ideas come from? I mean, Hegel didn't just get his ideas by reading Spinoza and Kant and Leibniz, right, which he did. But there was also a spirit in the air produced by the French Revolution that motivated Hegel's discoveries philosophically. She goes into this in chapter 1. But where did those ideas themselves come from? Well, one of the ideas was the idea of self-activity, which we also call democracy, right? That self-activity is a very important conception in Hegel's logic. Without going into that more for right here, where does this notion of democracy come from? I was always told when I was in school, these great French philosophers came up with the idea of democracy and gave it to the masses, and that's what produced the French Revolution. Dunayevskaya's got a very different analysis, and she's not unique in this. There's other people that have pointed this out. Daniel Guérin wrote a wonderful book years ago on the sections of Paris in the French Revolution, arguing that it was the democratic spontaneous assemblies, or the sans-culottes, in the sections of Paris that actually generated the conception of modern democracy that we now have. And that when you really look at the writings of many of the philosophers, Voltaire especially, and Rousseau in particular, they weren't all that particularly democratic, frankly. Right? There's a lot of authoritarianism in both of them. So the idea of democracy came out of the activities of common people, okay? And this even influenced the writings of Hegel. Hegel was very influenced. He was 19 years old when the French Revolution happened, and he picked up that spirit of democratic self-activity that informs much of his own further philosophical development. Now that gets developed a lot more in chapters 2 and 3, where she goes into where did the idea of socialism come from. Again, socialism does not come from the head of intellectuals like Marx, she argues. And in a certain sense, you can say Marxism and freedom is one of the most systematic refutations or criticisms of the claim that was popularized by Lenin, but not invented by Lenin. It was invented by LaSalle, leader of the status socialist in Germany in the 1860s, and it was popularized picked up by Karl Kautsky, who then gave the idea to Lenin that workers on their own can only get the trade union consciousness, and socialist consciousness has to be brought to them by scientific intelligentsia. Well, she says basically the same thing. Yeah, she says basically bollocks in chapters 2 and 3 that it was these workers' revolts that generated these ideas of socialism. Now, many of these ideas of socialism were generated by these workers' struggles were unclear and moved in a not necessarily correct direction. But Marx didn't create it. Chapters 2 and 3 dealing with classical political economy and the 1844 manuscripts of Marx. But the biggest, I think, expression of this movement from practice and its impact on ideas and theory is what's, I think, very unique to Marxism and freedom, is how this impacted Marx's own development. And she does it on two different levels. One is what's now almost universally considered the birthplace of Marxism, the Paris manuscripts of 1844. This was not the case in 1958. Most people in the Orthodox left, at least the established Marxist left, kind of neglected them. But now that debate has kind of been, despite Althusser's claims, that's been resolved, a positive. You know that 1844 is really the key turning point. But what happens in 1844 is very interesting. If you read the 1844 manuscripts, beginning with Alienated Labor, but definitely the essay Private Property and Communism, what does Marx spend a lot of his time doing? Of course, critiquing capitalism, but not just critiquing capitalism. He critiques what he calls crude communism. Yes. And who are the crude communists? Good communists were those who equated socialism to the, simply to the abolition of private property, the nationalization of property, and the elimination of an anarchic market. So what's going on there with this? Marx is seeing that, of course he's against private property, of course he's against the anarchic market, but these are phenomenal surface expressions of capitalism. They don't denote the fundamental law of motion that drives capitalism. There's something deeper than property forms and something deeper than market relations that explains the capitalist mode of production. The question Marx is asking in 1844, which he's also asking in Capital, is what are the conditions of the possibility of private property? What's the conditions for the possibility of a free market? Once you answer that question, then you can answer the question, how do you abolish the free market and private property so they don't resurface in some other form, but you get to abolish them at their root? So what is the condition of the possibility of both private property and the free market? Well, Marx makes it very clear in the 1844 manuscripts, the condition for the possibility of both is alienated labor. That is, labor that's not only alienated from its product, but alienated from the activity of producing its product. Now, the alienation of labor as the source of the condition of the possibility of private property is going to strike a lot of people as a little strange, especially when, because Marx has a sentence in there, in the alienated labor, I think, essay, where he says, it may appear that alienated labor is the result of private property, but in fact it's the other way around. Private property is the result of alienated labor. And that gives people a lot of trouble to this day, that sentence, because it seems to be counterintuitive. You say, well, if I'm a capitalist and I can own my own business, I own the workers now become my private property as well as the business itself. I can force the workers to work as I wish them to do so I can augment my profit. So it's my property ownership over the workers that causes their alienation of their labor. But Marx is saying, well, that's true, but that's not the real root of the issue. The real root of the issue is, as long as workers are alienated from their own activity of laboring, it's necessary for an alien class to force them to do labor they don't wish to do, because people don't naturally want to do alienated labor. So you have to have an alien class or some kind of caste force workers to do what they wouldn't naturally want to do so long as they're alienated from their activity of laboring. So what he's really doing here is he's going deeper than the surface level, and he's looking at the fundamental germ of what drives what he later calls in Capital the law of motion of capitalism. Now, how does that relate to this question of movement from practice? I think what's going on here, why did Marx make this distinction between, why did he criticize the crude communists? Why didn't he go along with the rest of the folks that maybe were his friends or his colleagues? He respected Proudhon, for instance, a great deal for the first couple of years he was associated with him. Weitling, he was very good friends with socialists like Weitling, we could name many others, who were what he basically later calls crude communists. What causes him to take issue with them? Well, one thing I think that causes him to take issue with them is that Marx, when he gets to Paris at the same time he's writing these manuscripts, is hanging out with workers. And he's listening to them. And he's going out and drinking with them afterwards, right? And he's talking with them, and he's hearing what do they want out of life in response to the conditions of exploitation they're enduring. And he picks up that they want more than simply the abolition of the property deed. They want a transformation of the mode of work. They want a different human relationship, not only at the point of production, but certainly beginning there, but also in other areas of life, especially family life. Because don't forget, in the 1844 manuscripts, he has that wonderful attack on the community of woman and treating woman as an object of communal lust, right? So he's hearing those sentiments, and then he enters these theoretical debates, and he's developing a theory based on many of those sentiments that he's hearing. And he thinks out, as a theoretician then, what's the logical conclusion of somebody who doesn't hear those sentiments, and what's the logical conclusion that follows from thinking that the abolition of private property and the free market itself constitutes the necessary condition for socialism, right? He says, well, the logical conclusion of that is, and this, I'm quoting him, he says, you get rid of the capitalist, and instead society becomes the universal capitalist. That's what he says in 1844, 75 years before the Russian Revolution. Right? It's kind of an amazing anticipation of 20th century developments. Society itself can function as a capitalist, even without the capitalists, the personifications there. You can even cut off the heads of every one of them, and yet society itself serves the function of capital if the conditions that generate capital, alienated labor, are not overcome. So what he's doing is, I think he's doing two things that are going on at the same time. He's listening to that movement from practice, what workers are expressing, but he's not stopping there. He's developing a theory that would based on those sentiments, and then he's thinking out, as a good theoretician always has to do, what's the logical conclusion of that of the theory that flows from having been grounded in those ideas from workers. And this is what gives birth, I think, to a conception of what he calls in the 1844 New Humanism. So I think this gets to something else about Marx on a biographical way. I'm sorry if I just put it like this, but by the way, a lot of you have seen the film The Young Karl Marx. It's actually a decent film. The first time we had a film about the young Karl Marx, it was done in Germany last year.
Seen the play.
What's that?
Seen the play.
Yes.
Last summer.
Yes. But one thing that is always striking about Marx is the sheer intellectual energy of the guy. Right? He published so little in his lifetime, but he wrote so freaking much. And he was also active politically, and he had a family life, and he was an active person in so many other respects, and the conditions of difficulty and poverty and everything else. But the sheer intellectual energy he was able to put out, given all these conditions, you wonder, I always ask myself, where does that come from? It could be a personal trait alone, but it could also be a sense of responsibility that when he hears certain sentiments or ideas from workers, that he feels compelled to be responsible to give them a theoretical, systematic articulation and to fight with anybody else who doesn't see it. Because he's fighting with everybody else for the rest of his life, right? As a matter of fact, I don't think it would be an exaggeration to say that, because he's fighting with Proudhon for literally until his last day, you can do a study of Marx, just his critique of Proudhon, and follow through over 45 years, one tendency, and in a certain sense, it's the red thread of his entire work. So there's something in there that's not about sectarianism. It's about clarifying what is the goal that we're really fighting for, right? Which is what was at issue here. Now, there's a second aspect that relates to this that's even more, I think, unique or original for Dunayevskaya's analysis of Marxism and freedom, and that is how Marx got to Capital. That is the book, Das Kapital. How did he get to write it? How did his main categories, much of which were not present in 1844, 1844 actually is kind of weak on the economics on certain levels. That's true also, by the way, as late as wage, labor, and capital, right? It doesn't make a distinction between labor and labor power until the Critique of Political Economy in 1859. That's a pretty fundamental distinction. Because, Marx's analysis is that in capitalism, labor does not become a commodity. It's the capacity for labor that becomes a commodity. And that's a really big difference. Because if the problem is that labor becomes a commodity, you as a laborer become a commodity, that means that you become a thing. But if you're a thing, how can you complain about being a thing? Because things don't complain. Mm-hmm. Right? So he realizes, he's been writing about capitalism for 10 years already, he realizes there's a problem in his own analysis, because he's accepting the language of bourgeois economics that labor is a commodity, okay? And he says, but labor can't be a commodity because if it is, there's no source of active resistance to the commodification. But there is resistance to the commodification. So how do you explain that? Well, he explains it by splitting the category of labor between labor and the capacity to labor or labor power. So actually what you do is it's not your labor activity that's commodified, it's your capacity to labor that's commodified. But your capacity to labor is never the full total of yourself as a human being. There's much else that's true about you, so this allows you to resist that thingification or commodification. But anyway, without going more into that, how did he write Capital? How did he get to these ideas? Now, this is something that very few people have actually done, but Dunayevskaya argues in three chapters, 5, 6, and 7 in the book, and a lot of it is on the process by which Marx wrote Capital, that Marx's Capital was deeply influenced and restructured and rewritten based on actual are social movements and struggles happening at the time. And the most important of which are the struggle for the eight-hour day, the shortening of the working day, which was a big issue in the 1860s, and the American Civil War. And also the freeing of the Russian serfs from serfdom and the beginning of a revolutionary peasant movements. Not beginning, but the surge of revolutionary peasant movements in Tsarist Russia. All this is happening while Marx is shifting around the structure of capital in the early and mid-1860s, and the book in 1867 looks very different than what he envisioned in 1859 when he published the first book, part of it, Contribution to the Critique of Political Economy. So here's a very interesting thing, is she says, she's making the claim, and it's a fascinating claim, actually. It's a number of people have picked up on it since, by the way. I've found this has been a source of quite, a number of people have written on this and picked up on this since. But she's argued, because when you read the convention, I mean, if you read what most intellectuals write about the development of capital, it's like, here's this draft, here's that draft, here's this draft. Marx read this thinker, Marx read that thinker, Marx read this thinker. Marx changed his mind about A, B, C, and D, and here comes out capital, right? It's like the rest of the world is, it's like he's in his study, he's in the British Museum, locked away from everything else, right? The movement from practice doesn't enter in, or into the core of the analysis. But she's arguing that when he sees the movement of slaves in the Civil War, this makes Marx realize that the role of the subject, the subjective element, has to be brought out more prominently in his work. And the relationship to subject and object is a very tricky, difficult relationship to capture theoretically, and he's not quite satisfied that he's captured this subject-object relationship, the object, the objective side being the alienation, the reification, the thingification, but the subjective side being the resistance. Now he's seeing more resistance coming right up in the surface of things. And he restructures capital in light of that. So some of you may realize that he originally intended capital to be structured in a very odd way when you look back on it. He was originally going to begin the book with 300 pages of discussion about what other bourgeois theorists said about capitalism and critique them for 300 pages. And then he was going to get to discuss the nature of capitalism, because that was the traditional approach, right? You critique what other people, it's like writing a doctoral dissertation. First critique the literature, critique what everybody else says, and then you get to your position, right? But the problem with that is it reduces theory to a debate between intellectuals, right? So he decides in 1860, it's late, it's 1863, 1864, he's going to flip it around. Those hundreds of pages are going to be pushed to the end of the book, and they get published after his death as theories of surplus value. Instead, he's going to begin with the cell form of the commodity, the fundamental cell form that defines capitalism, the commodity. Bingo, he's going to begin there, right? And he's going to show the subjective-objective connection by analyzing the logic of the commodity, and then from that, the logic of the labor that creates the commodity, the dual character of labor, from that, the forms of value that flow from the dual character of labor, from that, the fetishism of commodity, blah, 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 okay? So the point here is that real life events stimulate Marx to rethink and change his direction in what he does on capital, to replenish his theory with a deeper connection to revolutionary subjectivity. Now, this connects to something that it's kind of my pet peeve, I'm going to be honest about this. You guys know that, of course, that chapter one of Capital is pretty difficult. It gives a lot of headaches. That's why Althusser kind of cheated and said, don't read it until you get to the end of the book. If Marx wanted you to read it last, he would have put it last. And he says, in the preface, he says, I'm sorry I have to begin with this very difficult chapter one on the value form and this very abstract discussion of value, but, in the analysis of economic phenomena, just like the analysis of in chemistry, you don't begin from the most immediate and phenomenal, you have to begin from the most essential. And to get to that, you have to use the power of abstraction, use that phrase, abstract away from factors that don't reveal the essential, but that it means you're working at a high level of abstraction. But that's where you have to begin. Now, in the last 20, 30 years, Dave knows this better than I do, this material, but there's so much stuff that's been published on the logic of capital, value theory, blah, 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 and there's more books written on this than I can count. But you know what's very curious is what most people not only don't account for, but don't think they even have to account for, is not just what goes on in chapter 1, but there's a little, it's not a little chapter, it's one of the largest chapters of Capital is chapter 10, called The Working Day. And The Working Day is this very beautiful and ugly at the same time, because it's not good things he's reporting, but it's a description of the nature of the working day. And what happens when workers go to work, how long is the working day, their fights to shorten the working day, why is that of significance, how does it impact society? He's got this, and by the way, it's the clearest chapter of Capital. Nobody reads chapter 10 because it comes out confused by what he's saying. Chapter 1 causes a lot of confusion. But it's like, it's almost like they belong in two different books to some people. And I've heard many people ask me, what's it doing in the book anyway? Why should the book, chapter on the working day, be in a book tracing out the value form and the abstract logic of Capital? Because this gets in the way of it. And it doesn't seem to fit, right? One is abstract, the other is concrete. I think if you can answer that question, why the two of them go together and why Marx insists they be in the same volume one of Capital, then you can claim to understand Capital. If you think you can get Capital by reading chapter one alone, which is very, very important to do, but you can't account for the working day chapter and the other chapters associated with it, then you really haven't gotten what he's doing. Just like you don't get it if you just only look at the working day chapter and don't deal with chapter one. So, in other words, this is the kind of a... Marx is able to critique abstract forms of domination without taking his finger off the pulse of human relations. And that's very important to do, because capitalism, as he says in the Grundrisse, is different from all other forms of exploitation because it's a system of abstract domination. We're dominated primarily in capitalism by abstract entities, like socially necessary labor time. Right? We're dominated by abstractions like the market. We're dominated by abstractions like money. Money is just an abstraction. What is money anyway, right? It's a mental abstraction, but we're dominated by this abstraction. We're not simply dominated by concrete entities or other people, although we're dominated by that too, but they actually themselves are generated or moved where they are by these abstract forms of domination. But how do you not get swallowed up in the abstract forms of domination and not be able to posit or point to an alternative? Well, you have to keep your finger on the pulse of human relations. So this is what her analysis of Capital is. I hope you'll find that it's got a lot in there. I mean, those chapters have to be read carefully because she's putting those two sides together. One side note to this. The kind of the vulgar explanation, not vulgar, the prevailing explanation, what is Marx's basic theory of value consist of? Oh, labor is the source of all value, right? Labor is the source of all value. And the value of a commodity is determined by the amount of labor time embodied in the commodity. So two commodities have equal amounts of labor time embodied in them, therefore they can exchange for each other, because two things can't exchange for each other unless they have a common element. Basically, that's kind of the garden variety description of what the theory of value is in Marx. But, you know, when you read Marx a little more carefully, you realize, first of all, Marx did not invent the idea that labor is the source of all value. That goes back to Smith and Ricardo. That's a bourgeois conception, that labor is the source of all value. And second of all, it's not true that all labor is a source of all value. Only a particular kind of labor is a source of value. The only kind of labor that's a source of value is labor that is governed by socially necessary labor time, a social average of the amount of time that's necessary to produce that commodity on the world market. In other words, the only kind of labor that's a source of value, according to Marx, is abstract or homogeneous labor, labor that is governed by socially necessary labor time. So in other words, Marx's theory of value is not simply saying, oh, the workers create the value, but they don't get the value back in their wages and benefits, and that's what's wrong with capitalism. If that's where he stopped, then he's basically saying the problem of capitalism is unequal distribution. And if we come along with a Keynesian welfare state or reform measures to pay workers more money and redistribute value from the rich to the poor, then the problem of capitalism is resolved. Which, by the way, a lot of people think that's the way to go today, right? I mean, you'll have to mention Jerry Lee Coleman's name in order to convince you of that, right? And in the U.S., this is even a bigger issue. We have a whole new generation of people who have self-declared, become socialists in the last 2 years. I mean, the Democratic Socialists of America went from 4,000 members 2 years ago to 55,000 members today, right? It it's a remarkable development. It's the first time we have a mass socialist, quote-unquote, party of some form in the United States in something like 100 years, right? So it's a significant development. But I go to these meetings and I ask people, what do you mean by socialism? Oh, it's Bernie, you know, it's Bernie. It's like, tax the 1%, and give it to the 99%. Okay, I'm for that, but that's not socialism, right? No, that is socialism. Oh, what is socialism? We get into this discussion. So a very fruitful moment to have this kind of debate. Anyway, the tangent I was getting on is, Ryan uses the phrase in chapter 7, I think it is. She says, actually, it's more accurate to say that, not that Marx had a labor theory of value, because he was saying only a particular kind of labor creates value, abstract or labor that's governed by socially necessary labor time. She says it would be more correct to call it a value theory of labor. Beautiful expression, a value theory of labor. That is, Marx is critiquing not just the fact that the workers don't get paid enough value or get enough value back that they create by the capitalist, he's critiquing the fact that labor takes the form of value to begin with. Why should any society measure a person's contribution to society based on a monetary abstraction? Why should your labor count only insofar as it augments profit or doesn't? That's what his object of criticism is. He's saying the form of labor is conceived of in a value integument, a value form. And that's what he's attacking. He's also attacking the inequality that the worker doesn't get paid the full fruit of their labor. But that's a secondary consideration. The primary is the human relationships that become so distorted that we treat human beings like things, like commodities. That's the problem. As long as that problem is not resolved, you can call any society anything you want, but in the final analysis, it's still capitalism. But that problem is not resolved. And I think that's the lesson of the last 100 years. At least that's the argument she's making. Okay, so, I don't want to go on too long. The discussion is more important to me. The basic point I'm getting at here is, again, we see two things going on here. Is Marx is, on the one hand, listening to this movement from practice, listening to impulses from below. What do workers or other people who are struggling for freedom really want out of getting rid of capitalism? But then responding by theoretically thinking out comprehensively and systematically what that signifies. So this is why she uses the phrase, it's a very beautiful phrase, she says, no thinker can think out of their own head, and their thinking always depends on an active relationship with subjects of revolution and subjects of revolt, an ongoing daily resistance, but at the same time, the theoretician is indispensable. There is an indispensability of theoretician. And that sounds like two opposite things, but again, that's the argument that's being made here. All right. Now, a couple of things just to finish up here. The book has some very interesting discussion also historically, following the chapters on Marx's Capital on the Russian Revolution. Well, first of all, on the Second International, and what began to go wrong in Marxism as early as the formation of the Second International in 1891, which had Engels' blessing. Engels did some very, very important work when this devalued his contributions to Marx's development. But what went wrong that led to the Second International, that ultimately led Luxembourg as early as 1910, before almost anybody else, to see that it was a stinking corpse, and then 1914 it really stunk when they went and supported World War I. And then what happens with the Russian Revolution, which looked like such a promising beginning to steer Marxism back towards a revolutionary direction, but then gets transformed into its opposite. So she has some very, very interesting discussions about what happened in the 20s under Lenin and the analysis of the rise of state capitalism as an economic system in the Soviet Union and elsewhere. Now, the last thing I just want to talk about is the very end of the book, she's got some interesting discussion. I think that's what Paul Mason, by the way, was picking out of. He may not have mentioned the book, but I think he got this from somewhere, from reading something by her. So it could have been the last chapters of Marxism and Freedom, or it could have been somewhere else, or it could have been the correspondence she had with Herbert Marcuse, because they corresponded a lot about this question. And that is, how does automated production, change the nature of capitalism? How does it change it objectively? Because we know that the logic of capital is what? It's to increase profit. How do you increase profit? Increase the productivity of labor. How do you increase the productivity of labor? Increase the amount of goods and services being produced in the same amount of time. How do you increase the amount of goods and services produced in the same or lesser amounts of time? Well, you do that by introducing labor-saving devices. What are labor-saving devices? Machinery, automation, robots, artificial intelligence, blah, blah, blah. So the logic of capital is to eliminate relatively reduce living labor relative to dead labor or capital. Okay? So objectively, this changes the world, right? You end up with a situation where the industrial working class shrinks relatively in size, but doesn't mean the working class itself shrinks, because now you have a huge service sector, right? But the point is that the production of high-tech capitalism reconfigures the working class and reconfigures the whole capitalist system in a certain sense. But what about the subjective side? What is the nature of revolt or resistance in an age of automation? How does that change the nature of resistance when you get to a very highly developed period of high-tech automation? And that was the debate that she is really getting into near the end of the book. And that's this is the debate in Marxist theory today. In many, many, many respects. It really speaks to it directly. There are, as you know, a lot of folks today, accelerationists, they're called, right, who essentially say, well, this is fine. We should promote the replacement of living labor by capital, dead labor, because the more that accelerates that process and we actually encourage capitalism on this path, because eventually what that will do is we'll eliminate the need for productive labor altogether, and then we would be at the new society because free time would replace labor time. Liberated from the tyranny or the necessity for labor time, we now can have free time because the machines will do the labor for us. Well, but the problem is, there's a lot of problems get raised with that. First of all, what about the ecological cost of this? Right? And secondly, what about the human cost of the person that's made into a cog in the machine? You know, I work at, this community college, and I can see it in my own college, where the administration is constantly trying to get us to streamline, they want us to turn, to quantify education, to turn everything into a quantitative measurement of graduation rates. And that what they're going to come down the pipe with sooner or later is quantitative measurement of how much money your students make 5 years after they graduate, you know, and which courses should be cut if they're not making as much. And of course, philosophy is the first to go, which I teach. So what about what course does this have to the human subject? What Dunayevskaya brings out here is she was living first in West Virginia in 1949 and 50. She took part in the coal miners' general strike against, it was the first massive wildcat strike against automation in U.S. history. 500,000 coal miners went on strike, not only against the coal companies, but against their own union leadership, because they had introduced the continuous miner into the production process, and their union leader said, look, that's okay, you're going to get a pay raise in the next contract. Go along with this, it's for the sake of progress. The workers didn't like this very much because a lot of people were being killed and maimed by these new machines, so they went on general strike. And she was there when it happened. That really influenced a lot of her writing in Marxism and Freedom on this issue. She then moved to Detroit in 1953, and that's where she lived until 1984. The last couple of years she moved to Chicago. That's when I got to work with her the last couple of years of her life in Chicago. Dunayevskaya's attitude was that the struggles against automation that were breaking out in wildcats and among various sectors of especially the U.S. workforce was raising a critical question that had not been as central to the socialist movement as it needed to be previously, and that is to move the question of the class struggle from fighting over the proceeds of labor to shifting it to the question, what is the nature of labor itself? What kind of labor should a human being perform? How can labor be meaningful as a form of human activity rather than meaningless drudgery? That's the fundamental human question. How can you end the depersonalization of the human personality, the human individual, through the subjection to automation and mechanical devices? How can you instead free people to have a new type of labor in which they sensuously express themselves and appropriate the gifts of nature in a harmonious manner? So This was, of course, a debate between her and Marcuse, because Marcuse thought, like the accelerationists of today, that, well, this would be a good thing. Let the workers, you know, have their automation. Let the workers not bother fighting the automation. We'll get something better out of it in the long run when we now have the material conditions for a new society established by material labor, no longer productive labor, no longer a dominating society, and free time dominating instead. She took a different approach, and she argued that the question of what kind of labor has to be answered in order to get to a post-capitalist society. And not just what kind of labor, what kind of human relationships. This is also something, it's another area of my work that I've moved more into in the last couple of years, is Franz Fanon and race theory. I got a book on Fanon. Fanon raised some of the very same questions, where he argued that the fight against colonialism cannot simply be for national independence. It has to be for a transformation of the human personality by those fighting for national independence. That is what he calls the creation of a new humanism that ends the fragmentation and alienation of the individual. Unless that is what the anti-colonial struggle focuses on, he said it'll end up in a halfway house of either neocolonialism or statist authoritarian tribalist states. And history has proven him largely right. So there's a real parallel here between Fanon and Marx on this kind of an issue. It's not discussed in Marxism and Freedom itself, but it's just something that logically follows from it. So, in sum, I think it's a great book to try to get into the issues that we're facing today, debates that we're having over accelerationism, UBI, right? That is universal basic income. These sorts of issues are really all, in one way or another, touched upon by the theoretical analysis, even if they're not explicitly addressed. But there's a lot of other things that are addressed here as well, implicitly or explicitly. Lastly, I'll just finish with this, is, I mean, Dunayevskaya was, in her own way, a rather modest person. I remember when there was a new edition, I guess it was this edition was being prepared, or the edition right before this. Yeah, I think it was near the end of her life, Humanities Books was going to republish Marxism and Freedom. And the publisher wrote her and said, well, you can write a short introduction if you want to evaluate to what extent your work has stood the test of time. So she said, she didn't say that, oh, everything I said is the same, I think, today. You'll see certain things that she says about Lenin and the Russian Revolution, by the way, that she changes over the years. She becomes much more critical of Lenin in subsequent works than she is in Marxism and Freedom. And there's not a separate discussion, for instance, in Marxism and Freedom about Trotsky. That shows up in some of her later work, not because she wasn't interested in Trotsky at that time. And there's other things that are somewhat different. But she said, she wrote the introduction, the new introduction, and she said, well, looking back, I don't see any need to fundamentally change any of the analysis of the Marxian oeuvre, the Marxian work, right? The analysis of Marx's work. And that's, I think, is important, because there's few books that can give you a better idea of Marx than this book. And that's a big job to do, because Marx is a very complex thinker. Not easy to figure out. And frankly, I think you guys, or all of us in this room, are the first generation of people who have the ability to figure it out. That's a big claim, but I just say that because we're the first ones that both have all of Marx's writings now pretty much available, right? I mean, not just the 1844 manuscripts, not just all the drafts of Capital, they all are out now. But also his later anthropological and ethnographic writings, his writings on women, his writings on Native Americans. Seiko Kato from Japan has just published a 300-page book on Marx's ecological notebooks done at the end of his life, where he was talking about the impact of destruction of the agriculture of the soil on the environment. Not to mention his excerpt notebooks and a whole sorts of other subjects. We're the first ones that really have it all before us that we can actually figure out what Marxism means for today and figure out where to go with it and how to reshape it and redevelop it. So I think Marxism and Freedom provides a real handle on being able to get into that work, which I hope that you'll all want to participate in. In the International Marxist Humanist Organization, we view ourselves as a unity of workers and intellectuals. We don't view theory as something that's done by the intellectuals and then the rank and file members go out and sell the newspaper. We've never operated on that principle. We've always operated on the principle of having meetings like this where everybody participates in the development of theory and where intellectuals make their contribution, but they also learn how to listen and learn how to not dominate, and also to encourage others who don't think of themselves as intellectuals or theoreticians to make contributions that are valuable, because they have valuable contributions to make in a collective process of trying to think these ideas out. So that's what we try to do with the International Marxist Humanist Organization. We're not a party. We're a decentralized international committee, but we've decided after the failures, the problems that we ran into with News and Letters, an earlier Marxist Humanist group, that we wanted an international committee, an international organization, where each person who joins is on equal basis anywhere in the world, and can we have an active discussion across national boundaries on these sorts of theoretical and political issues. Anyway, sorry if I went on a little long.